Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour for November 15, 2018. And a few interesting topics tonight. I'll be talking about the comet 46P Wertheimer, which is going to come near Earth about 30 lunar distances, LDs as they're called. And this is on, the closest approach, December 17th. This year, right before Christmas time, a week before Christmas, in fact. And interestingly enough, we will have a new moon on the 6th of December. And then the new moon, as the moon moves around, it breaks free of the Earth's magnetic field, basically the what we call the bow shock, or the region which is affecting the solar wind from Earth's magnetic field. The moon breaks is actually outside of that this entire time from the December 6th period, and then it breaks around. It's coming around. It not really breaks. I don't know if that's the correct term. It orbits around Earth and comes up to where it has a finger extending out from Earth in the direction of the comet. So the comet is going to come around to the night side of Earth and potentially give us a good view. And so the moon will be out of the picture here at the beginning of this period of time. So there may be a point at which we get a pretty good view of this comet. Some people believe it could be as large, the coma that is, could be as large as our full moon, which is pretty big in the sky. We have had comets, Comet Holmes. If you remember, I have a section on my webpage dealing with Comet Holmes. And you might want to go read that, as Comet Holmes exploded into brightness because of an alignment, a planetary and lunar alignment, etc. But I'm not going to repeat all that here. So Comet 46P Wertheimer, and you can find where this will be in the sky by looking online. There are star charts to tell you where to look at a given time. If nothing else, you'll be able to see this with binoculars or even moderate-sized telescopes, backyard telescopes. There will be some online telescopes so that people can see this through the eyes of a better telescope, through the modern wonder that we call the Internet. So if you're interested in this, just look up online, and then you will have to ignore all of the references to little ice balls and icy wanderers, whatever they say, because, and I'll be talking a little bit about that, in a little later in the show, kind of an illness that's occurring in the astronomy community and has been going on for a while. And I'm starting to attribute it to too much fluoride in the water. I think this was something that happened a number of years ago where they discovered real high volumes of fluoride. You know, the horrific chemical they put in water that they claim is good for your teeth. They found horrific levels of this in the water of certain universities around the science departments. And from what they call science today, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a little bit of Looney Tune, you know, help from fluoride going on, because that's apparently what it does. It makes people they lose it. They actually lose it. But anyway, going back to Comet 46P Wertheimer, the question, of course, always comes up regarding comets. Could it be a danger to Earth? Could it do something? And the answer is probably not. 30 lunar distances is very close. This is the 10th closest comet to come to Earth in history. Apparently, the very closest comet was a comet Lexel in like the year 1770. That people could see very well, etc. But the issue with this comet is that we'll be looking out at the comet. We'll have kind of a nose view, if you will, of this comet. and it will not be like a broadside. If you recall Hale-Bopp, we had a nice broadside view of Comet Hale-Bopp. But this comet, as with Comet Holmes, will be looking right up the nose of the comet. And so it's, you know, not the best viewing angle for a comet, but this will be, according to predictions, a relatively small comet. But if it does interact with Earth's interaction, the Earth discharge of the solar capacitor, if it interacts with that, I think they're just too far apart to have any interaction. So I don't want to make any predictions at all about weather modification due to the comet or anything like that. I just don't think it's going to happen. But anyway, we might get some good visual effect out of this. I talked about this comet last week, made a slight reference to it, and I did a little more studying on its orbit, and as a result can tell you pretty much that it's going to come around behind Earth. And it's not really, there's the moon is not involved other than being kind of a finger sticking out in that direction. So one out of 30 distances, the moon is at one lunar distance. This comet will be closest approach at 30 lunar distances. Electric current discharges can span millions and millions of miles. So if these two connect, then we could see some activity. We could actually see some serious activity. In fact, we could see, for example, the sodium tail of the moon pick up some steam. You know, if for those, you know, professional observers who have the ability through satellites to see the sodium tail of the moon. And I know there's tier one scientists that listen to this show now and then. And they will probably send that on, and I suspect that real Tier 1 scientists will be looking at the reaction of this comet and its electrical discharge with the moon, its sodium tail, and potentially interactions with Earth. Okay, so enough of that. Along with this story of comets, there has been more hype this week. Now, this is going into the zone of Looney Tunes with professional astronomers. Last week I reported that Harvard astronomers, these are the Harvard resident astronomers, who would you imagine would be the top of the creme de la creme, so to speak, the cream of the crop, the best in the world. And they, this comet, this object, it's not really a comet. They don't know what it was. It's just a long, thin object, about 1,000 feet long and about 100 feet wide. So it's just this long, thin thing. And so they thought, well, it's an unusual shape. And so the Harvard astronomers speculated last week in public that this was an alien spaceship. Now, mind you, they don't have any close-up pictures of this. The biggest telescopes on Earth had a few snapshots. And the reason they know this is long and thin is because of reflectivity of light from the object as it tumbled through space. Now, to me, it's like, yeah, it's not your normal asteroid shape. But literally, there's absolutely no evidence of any kind that would suggest this is an alien spacecraft of some kind. None. None at all. Yet the news media is filled with that story. This week, now, they're making the further claim, and now a lot more people have jumped on the bandwagon in the astronomy community, including Europeans now, and they're all jumping around, and they're going, ooh, this was a spacecraft that was accelerated by a light sail. In other words, let me explain what a light sail is. It's a big piece of material, very lightweight, and then the object, the theory, is that you would shine a laser beam on this sail, causing acceleration to a spacecraft. Okay, well, you know, it would work good in a Flash Gordon comic book, possibly. But and the whole idea here is that you don't have to have if you look at my paid cast, I went through a whole thing on propulsion systems and inertial propulsion systems, where if you have to carry mass along with you on an interstellar travel with a spacecraft, if you have to carry mass with you to heat up and eject in the form of a rocket, then this greatly increases your mass. Or to the contrary, if you have to scoop up matter, kind of like a jet engine does, it takes in air and then forces it out the back end at a much higher velocity. But there's a lot of drag associated with that engine. And so in outer space, there again, you would have to have some energy source on the spacecraft to heat up whatever you collected and then force it out the back end, out a nozzle. And so to eliminate all of this mass and mass ejection, one idea was to have a light sail where you shine a laser beam on a big sail and the photon pressure would make this thing move. Okay, well, you know, there are better ways to do this, by the way. There are better ways to go between star systems, and I've enumerated those. But to imagine, now let's get back to this Oumuamua needle object that came flying through the solar system in, what was it, a couple of years ago. It's like, I forget, I announced last week the dates. It was like October, you know, was it a year ago, 2 years ago, whatever. To imagine that this was an object that was accelerated by a light sail and actually publish this is such a stretch of the imagination. Now, let's just back up a little bit. Is there something unusual about something flying through space at like really high velocity? Well, when you look at explosions that have occurred in outer space through supernovas, etc., to imagine that there's stuff out there flying around really fast, although it's not common, statistically, if you have good telescopes, and we're very early in the era of having good telescopes and detecting this kind of thing, clearly it's probably something a bit rare. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen naturally. And to speculate that this is an alien spacecraft based on its velocity or other properties is really, really, really a stretch of the imagination. And, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, or back in the day of Carl Sagan, you might whisper this, if you were an astronomer from Harvard, you might whisper this in the cloakroom, in the closet, in the very back of your laboratory to somebody else and tell them, don't say I said this, but, you know, do you think it could be an alien spacecraft? But to actually put this out in the press and then publish this in respectable peer-reviewed journals is such a stretch that it's an indication to me that the astronomical community has simply kind of just kind of meandered off the deep end, like an old person that meandered away from the old folks' home and beyond the gate and fell off the bank of the river. And, you know, that's the state of astronomy today. Now, I want to go back just a little bit. Somebody pointed out to me this week, this is a fan, and talked to me and said that he had brought up my name on a blog and encountered what actually obviously turned out to be some trolls, and then would put up, as a result of my name appearing, a link to something called Rational Wiki, which is a total CIA trash page. And I'm not going to go into it. But anyway, one of the comments was that I say that dirty snowballs or comet nuclei that is, not dirty snowballs, but comet nuclei, real comet nuclei, don't exhibit any water or ice. And it's true. And so what they do is they point to, this is the point I want to make, they point to an article that talks about water in the tail of a comet. Now, of course, the stretch of the imagination here is that water came from the nucleus. So if you see, their implication is that if you see water in the tail of a comet, then it had to come from the nucleus. So therefore, that proves that there's water on the comet of a nucleus of a comet. And this is when you look at the photos of the many comets that have been visited by spacecraft, not a single one exhibits water, nor ice, nor snow, and most importantly, it doesn't exhibit anything coming off the nucleus. And the Rosetta mission from the European Space Agency had a lander, the Philae lander, landed on the nucleus of a comet, landed there, sampled the surface, and found out it was carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen compounds. In other words, organic compounds. No water, no ice, no snow. And they're right there on the nucleus, looking around. There's the whole nucleus in view. Not a shred of vapor coming off that would correspond. Now, back in the day, NASA had artist conceptions of what it would be like when you arrived at a dirty snowball. And they had gas coming out. Now, imagine this coma, the tail of a comet, is filled continuously at a very high rate. There would have to be, the nucleus of the comet would have to look like a locomotive steam engine with water coming off in all directions at high velocity, so it would come out and fan out and form this tail. When you get up to the comet nucleus, there it is. There's nothing coming off of it at all. So the point is that, you know, here we got astronomers from Harvard University talking about things up in space that they really don't have a good image of being alien spacecraft. You know, they're in a complete state of denial. When you look at any article that's published today, whether it's space.com or Science News or any of the other NASA mouthpiece, or spaceweather.com, there was just an article in spaceweather.com about a new comet that was discovered. This constant reference to icy, snowy, you know, comets are the remnants of ice and snow left over from the formation of the solar system, and they repeat it like a nursery rhyme. But it's not true. They're not going to give that up. So I told the person that told me about this exchange on a blog, I said, you know, they're not going to give this up. You're being attacked by trolls who are trolling the internet. And of course, the first thing when my name comes up, they put a reference over to some garbage page that just trashes my name. And, you know, this is very damaging, you know, in a sense. But what it does, the benefit to me is that people who have studied my work really know it. They understand it. They understand the delusional astronomy that's being pawned off today. When they see that, they realize that I'm pushing through all of this and maintaining my position, which I have over the decades, long before anybody even dreamed that comets weren't dirty snowballs. In the professional or unprofessional sense, I was dealing with this decades before anybody even dreamt about it. And in a lot of cases, before people were, you know, even born. So my point is that there is a mental illness in the astronomy community. And that's the only way I can put it. Maybe we could attribute this to some natural cause like too much fluoride in the water. But it's important to understand that, you know, this is it's an unfortunate situation, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. Okay, so enough of that. But the idea that astronomers are fabricating information, they're falsifying information, they're making logical conclusions that are not logical, they're taking data that you would find in the tail of a comet and by hand-waving, implying that it came from the nucleus, and therefore the nucleus must have water, there's proof that comets have lots of water, is beyond absurd. Because you look at the nucleus, there ain't no water, ice, or snow. Okay, so I don't want to belabor this too much, but it's important to understand. Now, I'll just take this a little step further because of other encounters I've had recently with people who are in that professional. They might be engineers. They might work at one of the California universities. They might work at one of the Eastern universities, and they have this arrogant kind of they stand behind arrogance, and this is another point that if they can be arrogant and stick together as a group, then they really don't have to talk about anything real. They can just continue on with kind of a smug arrogance. So anyway, that's a whole issue unto itself. But there again, science has no place for arrogance or feelings or emotion or anger, all of those things. Science does not have any place for these. But unfortunately today, science is controlled by these very human emotions that have no place in science. So you can't really call it science. For a long time, you could not call it science. But right now, it's a mental derangement syndrome amongst very well-educated people, if you want to call them educated. And this goes into so many fields. At any rate, okay, enough of that. But I just want to, here's the thing. I've had so many encounters with this type of thing lately, and it's a symptom of modern society. For example, I was not going to talk about the political election too much, but I did when I was on the Power Hour the other day last week, Wednesday. I did a discussion on voter fraud. Well, this week, the voter fraud news is going viral, and they're actually discovering people creating boxes full of votes. And one of the other things, now I add this to my list of 11 ways to cheat in an election. Number 12 is to have the ballots stashed someplace to where they're going to locate them later after the election. If there's not enough votes in the election, and they're finding this in Florida right now, and the woman who is controlling is at Dade County down in Florida, Debbie Wasserman Schultz district, and also they're finding for the gubernatorial race, the Debbie Wasserman Schultz race, and the Ron DeSantis race, all high levels of corruption on the Democratic Party, and who are infiltrated into the local precincts for all types of different types of cheating. So, but anyway, they're starting to demand that the records and the to go in and actually investigate the records, etc. And they're not, these local precincts are not turning over the records, which is, pretty much indicative that there's some hanky-panky going on there, and it's not just a little bit, it's a big bit. And so those elections there, I said too that I said that Florida would have a hurricane prior to the election. And it sure did. It was called Michael, I think, or Mike, something like that. I actually predicted something a little bit different. I said it would come in to the Dade County region, but it didn't. It came up through the northern part, but still heavily affected the two statewide elections of senator and governor. So this is all yet to be sorted out. And as I said on the Power Hour, I went, for example, in Texas. I looked at the voter count in Dallas, the western. There's two counties that covered the city of Dallas, Texas. The western of the two counties had like 80% Democrat vote. This is for the Senate, the Ted Cruz Senate vote. And then you go across the street one county over and it's flipped the other way. Now, it's not logical that you would cross a street and find that big a difference in the sentiment of the people. And so what it tells you is that those big city voting regions are where the cheating takes place. And so the same with Houston, the same with San Antonio. But if you go along the Texas border, a very interesting phenomena occurred in that if you look by the county-by-county voting, that, and by the way, those are the counties that have the biggest problem with illegal alien trafficking, drugs, M13, human trafficking, violence, robberies, etc., that those people would have the highest probability of voting to have border security. But what was interesting is that I looked on the county-by-county basis for both the Senate race, the Cruz, the other guy, what's the other guy's name, the Senate race, O'Rourke or something like that, and then also the other state elections, like in terms of representatives. And what you found is for the representatives, it was all of those border counties in Texas went Republican. But for the Senate race, they all went Democrat. Now, that means that a high percentage of people would have had to walk into the voting booth and voted for, what is his name, O'Rourke, for the senatorial race, and that was Democrat, and then voted Republican for the representative race. And this doesn't make any sense at all, because it was the major issue here was border security. Were we going to have border security or open borders, as far as the state level in Texas is concerned? So whether you're Democrat or you're Republican or anything in between, it does not make sense that this high percentage of people would come in and vote Republican on one level and Democrat on the other. It just doesn't happen, because this issue was the same in both races. And so clearly fraudulent activity indicated. And also, this was something that struck me. If you look at the national map of representatives to the House of Representatives, it's being clearly stated now that this was a fraudulent election and they did not take the House of Representatives by vote. But if you look at where those 219, this is right after the election, if you look at where the 219 representatives, House of Representatives, came from, they were about 10 districts. And they were highly Democrat, and the entire rest of the country is red. So you have a majority of representatives coming from a very small percentage area-wise of the country, because the representative vote is based on population. But as soon as you get out of the counties where those representatives won, it flips. And so anyway, it's The end result is this was the same analysis that I did for the 2016 presidential election using regression analysis, a statistical technique that you use the data after the election, not before. And this is not based on polls. This is based on actual data. It's very clear that, once again, there's about 10 cheating centers in the United States. And that was enough to get Hillary Clinton 17 million extra votes in the presidential election, which she did not get. They say she won the popular vote, which is not true by any stretch of the imagination. The same pattern, the point is, the same pattern occurred in the midterm election. Those same locations, the same, I call them cheating centers. So you'd go to Washington, Oregon, the San Francisco Bay Area, then down towards Southern California, L.A., that region. Then you jump over to Houston, Dallas, and the big cities in Texas. Then you jump up to the big cities in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And then the other states in the Northeast, and all the rest of the country is red except for Dade County, where we know there was vast cheating going on. So anyway, at least they have breached the topic now. The topic of cheating in elections has come to the forefront, and I hope there's serious investigation this time, because the people of the United States deserve fair elections. The cheating has been rampant, and I have done my part as far as sending my regressive analysis information up to the federal level. I don't know if it gets looked at. There was supposed to be a commission on voting fraud. They came back and said there was no indication of voting fraud when there was vast indication of voting fraud in the 2016 election. But anyway, hopefully now the Pandora's box has been opened, the Pandora's voting box, and hopefully there will be some serious investigation to find out. And probably what we'll find out is there are a lot of senators who may have never even won a real election, but are in office because of cheating. Okay, enough of that. A note here that China is sending a probe to the moon, and it's called Change 4, and apparently this is a carryover from many, many years ago, but decades ago, actually, where China was going to put some craft on the moon to study it, etc. But the part that's interesting here is that they plan to bring back moon rocks. Now, the Russians had moon rocks before the first Apollo launch, and back in the 1969 time frame. The Russians already had moon rocks. It was well known. And, of course, that was in the heat of the Cold War. But the Russians admitted they didn't go to the moon. And the Russian scientists that I worked with rather chuckled when the topic came up of NASA going to the moon because of the Van Allen belts. The Russians had a very early big rocket capability and a lot of power. They were their little Cosmos. I have this on my website. It's actually a picture of the Cosmos craft, a little shuttle-type craft that could carry three men, go up into orbit, circle the Earth, do reconnaissance, etc., and then come back down and land on Earth. And they had so much power from their rockets that they could put the nose cone, their payload, on a big rocket. And then they had so much lift capability that they would put this Cosmos little shuttle vehicle on the tip. And they'd take off, and so they had something like 1,100 flights between 1965 and 1976 during the Apollo era. They had thousands of people in space as we waited for a year and year out waiting for the next Apollo launch to occur. So anyway, my point is that Russia had the ability to go to the moon. They put a craft on the moon, picked up moon rocks, and brought them back. They also had a laser finder, a prism. And so the two, I just read this the other day, that there was somebody arguing about if NASA went to the moon or not in the Apollo program. And it's something that ICE-8 is just it's an unproven scientific claim, and that's stated in public on my webpage so that people don't misquote me. I'm misquoted all the time. McCarney says NASA didn't go to the moon. I said, well, no, it's an unproven scientific claim. There's no proof of it. The only proof is what NASA says. And, coming from never a straight answer, well, it's hard to believe anything that they say, especially when, when they think that this thing coming through space is an alien spacecraft. Anyway, enough of that. But China is going to bring back moon rocks. The idea that because the United States has moon rocks, that proves that man went to the moon. Nah, sorry. Russia had moon rocks, didn't go to the moon. China is planning on picking up moon rocks and bringing them back, unmanned space exploration. But what's interesting about what the Chinese are doing is that they're going down into a crater and up to a crater wall. Now, here's a crater that blown out. It was like excavated by an explosion, by an impact. It's an impact crater. And so they're going to go up and hopefully see into the layers of the moon. Now, this has never been done before. And so they're going to extract rocks that are truly moon rocks. Now, it's something I said before, that the Apollo-era lunar rocks were surface rocks and had absolutely nothing to do with the history of the moon. Absolutely nothing, because anything on the surface of the moon has come in from afar. Or it could have been some kind of impact where it took some of these rocks. So it's a hodgepodge, it's a mixture. And if you went to the surface of the moon and just picked up a rock, you would have no real knowledge of the history of that rock. Is it part of the original moon? Is it something that flew in from outer space, from another galaxy? I mean, you don't know. You have no way of knowing the history of that rock. So what the Chinese are doing is very intelligent. It's the first time. In fact, the U.S. scientists are not allowed to deal with Chinese scientists because of an international congressional edict that says that U.S. scientists cannot work with outer space issues from China. It's kind of a old heirloom law. But the U.S. scientists are very anxious to get data from these rocks that the Chinese are going to pick up because it comes from down in the layering of the moon, not from the surface. So this is very interesting. This is going to happen in the future here. And plus, they're also looking at studying the moon so they understand the surface conditions on the moon. But also what will be interesting is to see if they come up with this Apollo-like surface area with fine, fine powder, which many people have pointed out is not what you would find on the moon, because that implies atmospheric conditions. It would imply possibly ocean or water conditions, and not be indicative of a planet, a minor planet, as the moon is, that was allegedly never had an atmosphere or water. Also, the spacecraft is going to have spectrometers, so it'll be able to examine the material that they scrape away from the side of this crater wall. Very interesting. So the Chinese are making their bid for outer space, and the United States, really the last thing that the United States did relative to the moon was the so-called Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that allegedly took pictures of the Apollo landing sites, but I remember that they announced that on a certain date these pictures would come back and they would release them immediately, thusly proving that that NASA went to the moon and to show the Apollo landing sites. And there was just a big hoopla for a long time. I mean, all the time this lunar reconnaissance orbiter was in development, and then the launch, and then, you know, then the first pictures came back, and then the magical day came, and then nothing. This was manned by the University of Arizona Astronomy Department, who's had some pretty shady dealings in the past. And I've had some run-ins with some of the astronomers from there. In fact, some of the lead astronomers back in the day when they were distraught over my plasma discharge comet model. But at any rate, the photographs came back from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter of the alleged Apollo landing sites, and it looked like somebody had etched in a couple pixels with some pencil scratching around it to try and indicate where the alleged lunar Cadillac rover drove around on the moon. But there was just a disgrace. Your cell phone camera could have done much better. But anyway, that's the last big hurrah that the United States had relative to the moon. And it does not have anything planned. You know, I'd really hate to be a NASA scientist, because there's really, actually in NASA, there are some good people, there's some honest people, but they just, the work is too far, few and far between. It's really not, you know, for given the amount of money that we've spent, the amount of time, the amount of science hours, scientific man hours we've put into space, very little has actually happened. Also in the news recently, and some other public discussions, etc., regards heavy elements and where the heavy elements came from. Now, this is something that I've done work in myself, and here's the issue. Uranium, other stable forms of heavy elements that we find in the ground on Earth. Of course, the source of all of this is the Earth. We have not had spacecraft that can go out and actually harvest anything from the great unknown beyond our own Earth's surface. So the Earth has splotches of heavy elements, specifically uranium is one of them, where there are concentrations in certain areas of Earth. And if we could go down far enough, we'd probably find layers and regions where uranium was prominent. But the question is, in the greater scope of the universe, is where did these things come from? Because when we look at a star like the Sun, with the fusion, they are building up the very small elements. You know, you start with the hydrogen and helium, deuterium, and so on. You might get up to carbon in some of the stars, but that's about it. So how do you get these massive conglomerations of nuclei, etc.? There has to be some process that brings these atoms together and therefore, you know, cooks them, so to speak, in the nuclear chemical broth to create these large nuclei. And then the further question is, how do they get distributed in such quantity that we can actually detect them on planet Earth and on the surface or in certain regions? How exactly does this happen? And so this has been a mystery for a long time. But scientists now have concurred, and I don't agree with it at all, they have concurred that they have witnessed stars colliding. Now, these stars are colliding in other galaxies. These are very unusual events. And by the way, even if you go back to the alleged Big Bang, something else that there's just secondary and tertiary evidence for, not real evidence in the scientific sense. But even in that, the theoretical construct does not allow for the creation of the heavy atoms. And of course, once they're created, they typically have half-lives. They start to break down because they're unstable. They might be unstable on a very long period and then break down into further smaller components, etc. But, for example, on Earth, we know that there's plenty of uranium down in Earth because one of its byproducts is radon. And radon is a gas which is a real problem in certain areas where it's coming up out of the ground. It's a poisonous gas. It can get in your house, and especially in the wintertime, it can be a serious problem in that the gas is coming up, it fills the house, and turns out to be poisonous. But you can actually buy a kit. This is such a problem that there's a little kit you can buy, and you put it in your house to measure the radon to see if you have a radon problem. You would be surprised how many places have a radon problem. But in the scientific sense, this is an implication that there is uranium down below the in the ground, because there's enough radon being given off to where it's causing enough that it causes health problems in people. And this is constantly turning over. So every time you open up your doors or air out your house, or in the summertime when your house has maybe open windows, or springtime, then, of course, it all airs out because it's a gas. But the point is that if, like during the wintertime especially, or in places where you use air conditioning a lot, a big cement pad, it actually comes right up through the cracks in the ground and the cracks in cement, little areas where it can seep through, and it gets into the house in such quantity that it can pose a health issue. But that indicates that down below you, if you're one of those unlucky people, if it's down below you, there is uranium. That's where it's coming from. And by the way, they tell you to, you know, caulk all the cracks in your basement, etc. And you think, well, there's just a little crack there. How can your radon come through there? But it's like that's a pressure relief area, and it's a gas. It's trying to escape. And so it's going to find any crack and come through in volume. So you have to seal any cracks, any crevices, any open areas that might be below the house, so that it doesn't come in your house. Anyway, that's another issue. But in the scientific sense, there's uranium down there, and not just a little. For every radon atom, there's a uranium atom that released that. And now this is a process. It's called the half-life, and I'm not going to go into the physics of the decay, the spontaneous decay of elements, but there's enough uranium down there that there's a lot of it. I mean, there's really a lot of it. Plus, I mean, imagine the uranium that is excavated, etc., to make bombs and fuel nuclear power plants and everything else that nuclear, you know, is run, you know, submarines and aircraft carriers. There's a lot of uranium in the ground, and most of it is still in the ground. What we've managed to excavate and use in modern life is just a small fraction of it. So the point is, there's a lot of uranium in the Earth. Now, astronomers and theoretical physicists have agreed that the source of this uranium is from stars that collide. And when I look at this, first of all, okay, let's imagine two stars colliding, and it forms uranium, and that blasts out in three-dimensional space. As you go out farther and farther from that explosion, the concentration of this, it gets less and less. So it's kind of like a pulse, a spherical pulse that goes out that has uranium. And by the time it gets to Earth, the space between the uranium atoms is not enough to populate Earth with uranium. in concentrated areas. And this is the point. For example, let's look at the region, the reason they kicked the families out of those regions and burned them off their land up in Oregon was because that was an area rich in uranium. That was part of the Uranium One deal that the Clintons cut behind the scene to sell off 20% of the holdings of uranium. That was part of the deal. Or you'll go up to Saskatchewan, Alberta, in Canada. They burned all of those people out of their houses and then did not let them return. That was because they were preparing it for surface mining of uranium. Okay, so anyway, so why are there concentrations in certain areas and not where you are necessarily? You know, in this, we're talking about surface concentrations. So the question is, if these, if the formation of uranium occurs in explosions or collisions of stars, then there's no real reason, there's no logical carryover from that to indicate why concentrations of uranium would occur on Earth, or down below you there are concentrations, because we know that they're there because of the radon. Now, you can also go on the internet and just do this. Do a search, radon concentration map, or say radon map USA, or radon map Florida, or radon map Montana, whatever you want to, whatever place you want to look up. And there are actual concentration maps that show you the level of radon in your area. So that would indicate that this level of uranium concentration, which is directly related to the radon, is sporadic. It's not constant. And it's based on uranium concentrations. Okay. So this explanation that that uranium was formed by the collisions of stars, number one, it doesn't seem that colliding stars produces enough uranium to populate the Earth with that much uranium. And number two, it would populate it evenly only at the time when this crescent, or this crest, or this wave of uranium came by that came from a star collision. And there were, let me give you another statistic here, which is imagine you've probably heard the term colliding galaxies. When you think a galaxy is this, you know, billions of stars and it's coming together and it's colliding and all these stars are colliding. Statisticians have done calculations based on the cross-sectional area of a star and all the stars in the galaxy, and they estimate that two galaxies would move past through each other and there would not be a single stellar collision. Now, that's an interesting statistic, because if two entire galaxies pass through each other, you would think there'd be gazillions of stars colliding, and they're not. So the question is, are there enough star collisions to provide the universe with not only uranium, but the other heavy elements? And then the second question is, if there are collisions, how does that then populate a planet like Earth, which is just a speck of dust out in the middle of outer space, in concentrations in areas where there is uranium, in other areas where there is not any uranium to any significant level? Because as this uranium moves out from the explosions, it's going to move out evenly and spread apart. And the issue of how do you get the concentration on the planets does not add up. So what's the answer here? Is there something else going on? And whenever astronomers come across a conclusion like this, they like to jump all over it because it fits right in with their standard view of everything. And of course, my immediate view is that let's take a look at diamonds. I've talked about diamonds and the formation of diamonds. They're starting to find diamonds all over outer space. Well, traditional theory claims that diamonds form deep down in the Earth's center, where there's tremendous pressures, and these, I like that Superman episode when I was a little kid, and there's a diamond, and anyway, that was stolen or something like that. Well, anyway, they give Superman this piece of charcoal, looks like a piece of charcoal from a briquette, you know, like you use for the barbecue. Superman takes it in his hand and he crunches it down and opens it up, and there's a diamond. Nicely cut. Already cut and everything. Anyway, that's, 1950s TV. But, and that was the image of diamonds forming. But now it's understood that diamonds are found all over outer space. And I said the diamonds are formed in the electrical current, the electron current on the nose side of comets. Okay, so anyway, this leaves open also the possibility that the heavy elements are formed in the region around comets, where you have that intense electrical discharge and high energy activity going on. And so I'm not going to go into all the details, but this is on especially the sunward side of the comet nucleus. So now you have a mechanism by which you can form heavy elements, which is in the electrical sense. In other words, the ability to accelerate atoms to the point where the nuclei get close enough together that they fuse to form the heavy elements. And now you're dealing with something that's much closer to Earth. In fact, when Earth was a large comet, back in its original days, there's potential for this kind of activity at the level, energy level, to form, gold and on up in the periodic table. So, I don't buy the standard explanation that's just been jumped on, pounced on by the astronomy, physics, astrophysics community. I'm just about out of time. Just want to remind you, my webpage, jmccsci.com. The water filter products are there, greatest prices, best products on the market. My water filter elements take out chlorine, fluoride, arsenic without add-on filters. Ask any other vendor, and maybe unless they lie to you, they need add-on filters just to take out those basic rudimentary chemicals from your water. Plus, mine take out a lot more. And my filter elements cost less than their add-on filter elements. Once again, in all my books, CDs, DVDs, etc., the webpage jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.